connected to the Pilgrims from Paradise podcast with author and speaker Matthew Gallatin. Matthew is author of Thirsting for God in the Land of Shallow Wells, published by Conciliar Press. He's a former professor of philosophy and lives in northern Idaho. Here's Matthew.
Last time, I talked about how the dominant Western Christian theologies of salvation give us a picture of a God who faces a dilemma, a conflict between his desire to be merciful and his need to punish sin. And we talked about how in these theologies it is the cross which reconciles those two for God, that ends this inner tension that God must deal with prior to the cross, trying to balance mercy and justice. And I asked as we finished, what's the problem with this view? I mean, this is the view of so many Christians in the world. Well, when we think about God like philosophers, that is, when we think about God in terms of our own human experience, there is no problem. Most of us know what it's like to want to be kind and loving to someone who's done wrong, while at the same time feeling that we can't just ignore what they've done. I mean, things have to be made right. People with the power to affect others, parents, judges, teachers, etc., are too often well acquainted with the turmoil that this conflict of desires can create within us. And so we may sympathize with this Western God as he faces the same dilemma between mercy and justice, only on a cosmic scale. There's just one small difficulty, though. It is not possible for God to experience such a dilemma. In truth, it is not possible for the divine to have any sort of inner conflict, including one between its need for justice and its desire to show mercy. Most especially, it is not possible that God could have such a predicament solved by a physical act in time, namely, Christ's death on the cross. Why is all this impossible? It is simply because God, by nature, does not change. The scriptures are clear on this. Malachi 3:6, I am the Lord, I do not change. James 1:17, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. We human beings have inner struggles with conflicting desires only because we are changeable. We can go back and forth between two inconsistent feelings or longings, hoping to find some resolution or balance between the two. But in God, there is no such shadow of turning. In his heart, there can be no movement back and forth between requirements that are at odds with each other. To suggest that the demands of God's nature, his inner attitudes toward us, and his intentions for us could be altered as a result of the cross violates this great truth. God could not have been bound by his nature to punish all sin before the cross, and then after the cross be free, to whatever extent, of something that his nature required before. That would be variation, change, and serious turning. So, did Christ's death on the cross change nothing? Oh no, the cross, and even more importantly, the resurrection, changed everything. It's just that they didn't change God. They changed us. By the cross and resurrection, we have been born again. John 3, verse 3. Christ has defeated death and sin as a human being, thereby restoring human nature to its original state. Now, it is no longer the nature of human beings to die. It is their nature to live forever. In our recreated state, it is no longer our nature to sin. Now, because of our old habits and the sin-encouraging nature of the fallen world around us, we continue to struggle against temptation and the possibility of sin, and we still fall prey to it. But when we do, we act against our nature, not according to it. We must come to understand that God has never needed to have his honor fixed or his sense of justice assuaged. For him, the focus of salvation has never been resolving a personal struggle between his justice and his mercy. Before the fall, during the fall, after the fall, and after the cross and resurrection, God has been the same single-minded, self-denying, other-directed God of perfect love. His work of salvation has always been to transform human creatures broken by death and sin, and to restore them to intimacy with their Creator. This is the task to which the members of the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Spirit, are mutually and eternally committed. Another philosophically influenced problem with punishment theories is the very Platonic understanding of the human soul, which, again, though seldom recognized, lies at their hearts. Plato taught that the human soul is naturally immortal. Souls pre-exist the bodies in which they reside, and they live on after those bodies expire. Of course, most advocates of the satisfaction and penal substitution theories will deny that we are naturally immortal. St. Paul reminds St. Timothy that it is God who gives life to all things, and that immortality belongs to him alone. 1 Timothy 6, verses 13 and 16. It's true that human beings have an immortal existence, but this endless life is a gift of God that comes to us through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 21 and 22. As St. Paul goes on to teach in this passage, those who are Christ's and those who are his enemies have very different eternal fates. Nonetheless, Christ has given immortality to them all. So, what am I getting at when I say that these Western theories smack of a Platonic belief in natural human immortality? Well, this becomes evident when we think about the fate of the wicked in eternity within these theories. All of us living in the West have been exposed to the terrifying imagery of divine retribution. The wicked writhing and shrieking in the midst of agonizing flames, tormented beyond imagination through endless ages. Even though preachers these days are generally less willing than those of preceding generations to employ this vision as a serious motivational tool, the specter of inescapable punishment still lies at the heart of the dominant Western theologies. But here's something very few ever consider. Each of the tortured sinners in those hell fires is being kept alive by the active power of God. Through Christ, he restores human nature to immortality, yet what St. Paul told the Athenians remains true. It is in him that we live and move and have our being. Acts 17, verse 28. Or, as we just heard the apostle tell his protege, St. Timothy, it is God who gives life to all things. 1 Timothy 6, verse 13. God doesn't breathe life into us when we are conceived and then walk away. He doesn't wind us up like a clock at the beginning of our lives and then just let us run. No. He maintains our existence moment by moment. Every single breath, every single heartbeat is an act of His life-sustaining love. If God relaxed for a second, we would all perish. So, what does this mean for those who are devoted to punishment-based theories of salvation? Well, if they are going to keep their vision of tortured sinners, they must include in that picture the image of a God who, like a great heart-lung machine, actively keeps those sufferers alive in order to torment them. I can't help but think that if more people thought this through, there would be fewer advocates of the satisfaction or penal substitution theories. On the human front, most of us consider keeping someone alive just to be tortured is a heinous crime of unimaginable cruelty. So why are so many unable to see this injustice in their theory of a God who must aggressively punish the wicked? As I've suggested, it's the Plato in their Christianity. Like Plato, Westerners tend to think of immortal human souls as self-existing and self-sustaining. For some reason, once God gives us eternal life, we are no longer dependent on Him. I hear this clearly revealed in their words whenever Westerners speak of hell as a place of darkness completely removed from the presence of God, a place untouched and untouchable by the energies of God. But that cannot be the case. Throughout eternity, all of us will be just as dependent on God for our continuing existence as we are now. To conceive the wicked, or the righteous for that matter, as self-existent beings who will somehow be able to exist now without God, is to elevate them to divine status. Now, even if they become uncomfortable with elements of what they believe, advocates of the satisfaction and penal substitution doctrines still find ample evidence for their theologies in the many scriptural references to God's wrath. John 3:36, "He who believes in the Son has everlasting life, and he who does not believe in the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him." Romans 5:9, "Much more then, having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him." Ephesians 5:6, "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience." Revelation 6, verse 17, "For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" It surely sounds like God is going to come and unleash painful retribution on the wicked. Or could it be that this is just how Western ears influenced by 18 centuries of philosophical theological synthesis hear those verses? Could the wrath of God be something other than vengeance and indignation? First of all, we need to heed the words of Christ and accept that whatever God's wrath is, it cannot bear one iota of resemblance to human wrath. That's a little difficult for people who understand God in a philosophical way to do. They tend to see God in the light of their own emotional and mental experience. But Jesus is clear in Matthew chapter 5. If we want to be perfect like God, as he says in verse 38, not only must we not murder, but we must not even get angry. That's verse 22. Whatever God's actions may look like to us, we must understand that they cannot be driven by any human-like passions. One might argue that just because God cannot become angry does not mean that he cannot purposefully mete out punishment on recalcitrant sinners. As he looks on the souls languishing in eternal hell, he may do so without passion, calmly doing what justice demands, entirely untouched by the pain he sees. Still, it seems that to be so coolly objective, God would have to vigorously ignore that part of him that loves mercy. Or perhaps God's desire to be merciful to the wicked came to an end at the cross or at the judgment. But with a little thought, we realize that neither of those alternatives is acceptable. Why? It's because each requires some shifting or variation within God's being. As we've already seen, this is impossible. So, whether we look at punishment-based theories from the side of the redeemed or from the side of the damned, the result is the same. To hold to one of these theologies requires that one believe in a changeable God. But just like the Christ, the Father and the Spirit are also the same yesterday, today, and forever. Hebrews 13:8. It is paradoxical, really. Under the influence of a Platonic view that emphasizes unchanging order, the Christian West comes to embrace a changeable God. Now, how does this happen? Well, it's simply a measure of the incompatibility between the God of love revealed in the Scriptures and in the tradition of the ancient Eastern Church and the God of order in the Platonically influenced Western tradition. A God who empties himself for his human children, who is by nature compelled to visit blessing upon those who hate him and mercy upon those who reject him, this is an entirely self-denying God. On the other hand, a God who must visit punishment on humanity in order to satisfy his personal sense of honor and of justice can only be described as a self-concerned God. The two are polar opposites. So, if Christians in the Western tradition want their God to be both, then they have to allow him to move back and forth somehow between opposite personalities. Obviously, then, this God must have a significant capacity for change, something which the true God revealed in Jesus Christ does not have. So, how do we make sense of the notion of God's wrath? Well, many today just claim that there is no such thing. God is happy enough with all of us. There is no punishment coming, no price to be paid, no accounting to be given for our lives. But the Scriptures speak plainly, as we heard, of divine wrath. We cannot ignore its reality. So, to understand it correctly, what we have to do is abandon the theological, philosophical approach of the West and do what the Christian East does. We must hold fast to the truth that God is love. We must remember that he does not change, and then listen carefully to the Scriptures. When we do that, we see divine wrath in a very simple light, one free of the inconsistencies found in Western theories of heaven and hell. And we'll look at that next time. For Ancient Faith Radio, this is Matthew Gallatin.
If you'd like more information on Matthew Gallatin's ministry, visit his website at matthewgallatin.com. That's matthewgallatin.com. This has been a listener-supported presentation of Ancient Faith Radio.